All right, we will move on to the next case for this morning. Massengale Electric against NLRB. Mr. Seidman?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kenneth Seidman, and I'm the representative of the petitioner cross-respondent, Massengale Electrical and Mechanical, Inc. Massengale is a construction industry contractor. This case arises out of a salting campaign initiated by the United Association Local 172 in conjunction with the Indiana State Pipe Trades Association. We are here today principally because the administrative law judge and a majority of the members of a three-member panel of the National Labor Relations Board erroneously determined that Massengale unlawfully refused to hire and unlawfully refused to consider for hire 20 union organizers. The administrative law judge and board majority found evidence of animus and, having done so, failed to require the general counsel to establish his prima facie case of discriminatory refusal to hire and consider.
Well, the general counsel established that these people who applied at a variety of different times, actually, were not hired, that they were qualified, that there was the animus. We have now the affirmance from the Third Circuit of the standard the board used in the FES case. So that's, you know, something at least the Third Circuit thinks we can rely on. It seems to me that the kind of evidence that would rebut the inference is evidence uniquely in Massengale's control, such as evidence that there was a non-union person who had a three-month-old application in the file who didn't get hired, something like that. I mean, I have trouble seeing how it is we can get at the factual finding that the board makes, that the two reasons you cited, number one, your stale application policy, and number two, your wage discrepancy policy, it was a contested issue of fact whether those were policies. Because I think the board majority does say if they were policies, fine and well. But we have a deferential standard of review, and that's where I think this case needs to focus with respect to these various refusals to hire.
And I would like to address those, Your Honor, and I'm going to at this time. I'd like to first take the 13 applications that were filled out in January of 1997 but not submitted to Massengale until March 28, 1997.
Could you address the factual question about this? In the pipe trade brief, they indicate in a footnote someplace that one of those applications, in fact, had been filled out the day before the submission. I'll find it in a minute if you... Oh, here we go. It's on page 26, footnote 7. The application of one of the 13, Michael Bowen, is dated March 27, 1997, the day before the applications were submitted to Massengale. So that, at least, doesn't fit the pattern of your argument.
That was... I guess I would say I can't rebut that fact. When I looked back at the application, I did see that. I know it was turned in with 12... The other 12 applications at that time, so all were dated in January.
So, well, the others, you mean, were dated in January, which
that were turned in at the same time as Michael Bowen's altogether.
I understand that, but I'm just saying it sounds like the board might have inferred from the wholesale disregard of these applications that they were not looked at individually. If there was one that didn't fit at all within the rule that was used to reject them.
I would submit an entirely different response, Your Honor, and the point is, a company gets 13 applications, looks through the first three or four of them, all of them are dated in January. There's a very clear statement on the application, not on a pre-printed form, but specifically put in by Massengale, and immediately above the signature, applications will be considered active for 30 days. It has a whole stack, all submitted by one person at the same time, looks through several of the applications, they all show that they're late, misses the one person, discards them all, believing them all to be stale, and at most there's an error as not noticing that one of them was filled out the day before.
But the board didn't have to take that inference. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, what the board thought was that there had been, let's say, a variety of policies about hiring. Sometimes you use private investigators, sometimes you don't. Sometimes maybe there's a 30-day rule, sometimes there's not even a written application. And under those circumstances, I'm not sure it's a favorable inference for Massengale. If they look at the first three and see at the top of the page, which is usually in handwriting, as I recall looking at these things, voluntary union organizer, words to that effect, and just figures, oh, these were from January, we're just going to toss all 13 of them in the waste basket, figuratively speaking or literally speaking, that's not necessarily a good inference for Massengale.
The problem with the board's analysis, as pointed out very well by Member Herkin in dissent, and as we are articulating here and in the briefs, the board skipped its obligations. The board has to show that the applications are timely. That was confirmed and that was stated in portions of the FES case that an application must be active at the time of submission.
But what the difference between Chairman Herkin and the majority of the board seems to be is whether there really was a bona fide policy. The majority found the statement on the applications to be ambiguous as to when this 30-day period begins to run.
The evidence is uncontroverted, however, as to the language of the application and also Ken Massengale's testimony that it ran from the time that it was filled out.
That's also, the board had to believe Ken Massengale?
On the facts of this case, I think that the reasonable inferences to be drawn from all of the evidence and the only reasonable conclusion was, and this is where the board erred and why this court shouldn't defer, on all of these facts, the board did not show that these were active candidates. None of the 13 testified.
We looked at the applications, too. You can read the application. There it is. But your position is that the board was compelled as a matter of law to believe Mr. Massengale's interpretation of that application.
Standing by itself, no, I would not submit that. The evidence doesn't stand in isolation, and certainly the board has pointed out, and you've noted that there is other evidence of animus. But simply because there is evidence of animus and that Massengale may have done other things wrong does not allow the board to skirt its obligation to carefully review all the evidence and determine what happened with respect to these specific defenses. None of the 13, or at least the 12, ever contacted the employer to make any overt effort to obtain employment, didn't call in. They didn't submit their own application.
But why is that something that's so bad? I mean, if I want to apply for a job and I send my daughter in with the application because she's on her way past the place where it's supposed to be dropped off, does that mean I'm not interested?
No, it doesn't. But
and why does it also mean it's not interested if you have a union representative drop off your application for you?
Because they were 2 months late.
The timing is critical in a construction industry.
Well, I think that part is not. It's undisputed that the applications were filled out in January. The law is real clear. Mr. Massengale's testimony is clear. And common sense says in the construction industry, people quickly find work. And as those of you know, in January, when these people, if they did in fact fill out their applications, they may well have been available to work.
But why?
By late March, they weren't. It's the board's obligation to show that these people were willing and available to work.
But why couldn't the board have inferred from the fact that the people had an agent drop the applications off for them that was a sign of present interest and that the 30 days would run from receipt by Massengale instead of from the time you signed the bottom of the page?
There's several reasons why that's not the case. First, Jack Neal, who is the person who distributed, who dropped off the applications, testified specifically that he had not gone back to confirm whether any of these applicants were on the out-of-work list. He did not know whether any of the information on their applications needed to be updated in light of the two-month lag, did not know whether some of them were work, and admitted that some of them were not on the out-of-work list. In addition, one of the things that the Union Salting Manual, which is Respondent's Exhibit 4, page 23A of that manual, specifically says on the first point is, make certain you learn how long will the applications be considered. And the second point is, remember, you must call back every week to make sure that you keep your applications fresh. None of these people made any effort to show a real interest. If I'm interested in a job, I don't just give it to my union buddy and ask him to go deliver it 2 months later, never follow up when I'm normally working at a much higher wage with better benefits and different money. That's not reasonable.
Would it be enough, though, to uphold the board's finding of a violation based on Mr. Bowen? Obviously, the number of people at the compliance stage who would have to be instated and receive back pay would be down to one. Why does it have to be 13 or 12 instead of one, since Mr. Bowen's application wasn't late?
This court in StarCon and on remand, both here and on remand in the administrative law judge, as well as the board's decision in FES, emphasized that issues that need to be decided at the merits need to be decided at the merits. And a back pay and instatement order has to be decided on the merits. That can't be relegated to the compliance proceedings.
But I think there's a nuance here that's important, which is there are some kinds of things an employer might wish to raise, such as what you're suggesting, the 30-day rule, that would show no matter what, you weren't going to hire this person. And as our StarCon decision says, it's inappropriate to keep that off until the compliance stage. There are other things that would show, you know, maybe there were three people who you clearly would have hired, but you only had one slot, and it seems to me the line StarCon is drawing is that, in terms of how much your obligation is for reinstatement, might belong at the compliance stage, trying to figure out who actually would have gotten that one job of the three people who were not disqualified by the rules that you're presenting. So I think StarCon certainly puts part of this in the violation stage, but maybe not all.
StarCon said that a cease and desist order can be entered where there's evidence of an unlawful failure, but you can't determine who gets the job. But to the extent that you want to say who gets the job, that has to be proved in the hearing on the merits. And that's another fault in the board's hearing here. You'll find in footnotes, both in, I believe, in the ALJ and the board majority's opinion, saying during the relevant period, which is undefined, Massengill hired 20 or more than 20 plumbers. No one says what that relevant period is. Even assuming that the 30-day active application period runs from the date they drop it off on March 28 and not when they filled it out, which is not sensible, but nevertheless assuming that. Respondents Exhibit 5 shows the people that were hired by Massengill in the time period. And the applications of those people are dated, and within 30 days after March 28, there are only 7 applications that were submitted that are included within the people hiring. Now, the exactness of that could be better, but that issue wasn't flushed out by the board. And it's the board's obligation to prove availability of jobs. The board said it itself in FES. This court said you've got to prove those people have it, too. Those kinds of ambiguities in the evidence as to who would and wouldn't get the job must be redound to the benefit of Massengill. In this case, the board simply got lost in the evidence of animus. We can't dispute the evidence of animus. There's evidence of animus there. But that can't allow the board or the courts to ignore the burdens to establish. Thinking of an analogy to an employment discrimination case, if there's evidence that a company discriminates against older people, that evidence is in the record. That nevertheless doesn't mean you can avoid when that evidence is not directed to what's being challenged in the case. You still got to look what happened in this case. And here, Member Hurtgen, I think, is directly correct. The application says on its face 30 days. It's not part of the pre-printed form Massengill added. Ken Massengill's testimony was unrefuted as to how that would come in. Common sense also says, knowing a person in the construction industry gives me an application in March, I mean in January, by the end of March they're likely to be working. And if they were really interested, why didn't I get a more fresh application? Why don't they call me? Jack Neal did. He turned in an application dated early January of 1997. His is dated, I believe, January 6, 97. He turned his in on March 28th. What did he do? He called back. When he called back, what did Massengill? Massengill brought him in to consider him for a job. He had a stale application, but by expressing his interest in the job, now we know he is interested. The board's position that some people didn't get, were hired on the spot, so to speak, is a red herring. When I show up at the door and I say I want to go to work for you, I'm showing my present interest in work and my availability. And all of those people were, in fact, required to submit an application. We simply believe, in light of all the record evidence, that this court should reverse the board to the extent that Massengill has contested the points raised in this appeal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Kelly?
Good morning. May it please the court, Siobhan Kelly for the National Labor Relations Board, which is seeking enforcement of its orders in this proceeding. This essentially is a case in which the company committed or reacted numerously and unlawfully to the union's attempt to organize its employees. I'd quickly like to discuss first the company's hiring of four employees and its unlawful reaction to them once they discovered that these four employees were indeed union adherents. And then I'd like to turn my attention to the company's refusal to consider and hire the 20 union applicants. Very quickly, the company coercively interrogated two of its employees once before it found out that they were union, and then once after it found out they were union employees.
It seems like pretty mild coercion to me. Basically, Mr. Kerr just says, do you know these union people? Or he's not saying too much, is he?
Well, he's asking, do you know the union people, and are you yourself members of the union, in the sense that he now sees union people coming onto his job site and applying for jobs, and now he doesn't want this to happen, so he's trying to figure out who on his job site is part of the union. So just because they were, at the first time that they were coerced, the company did not know they were union. So Ross Morehouse doesn't even apply in that case. But it is still, the context is still coercive in that sense.
So and the board thinks anytime somebody is asked the question, are you a member of X union, it's coercion?
No, that's not it at all. A company is allowed, certainly, to ask and to know what's going on their job site. But the context of this interrogation certainly suggests that it was coercive. There's a long and open hostility to the union. There's a lot of other ULPs, some of them are uncontested, that are going on at the time that these questions are being asked. And so under that context, the board was certainly reasonable in finding that they were indeed coerced. The company also made an unlawful physical threat to one of the employees. Employee Joe went out on economic strike, and when he came back, he made an unconditional offer to return to work, and the company essentially told him that he was a wanted man, that everyone on the job site had hunting licenses and shotguns, and that he would never be hired back for everything that had gone on at the job, that everything certainly including his protective strike activity and his organizing activity.
Why should we think that Kurt was being serious when he made that statement about everybody having hunting licenses and shotguns on the site?
Well, other than the fact that he made the statement, he was upset because the guy's coming back and continuing to want to organize his employees. There's no reason to believe that he wasn't, that this was some kind of a joke. I mean, I'm not entirely sure that would be particularly funny. And he, in a situation where he's coming back and trying to get his job back, and he's being told that people have hunting licenses and shotguns, and because of everything that's gone on here, your organizing activity, your strike activity, we don't want you back on here. And so that the board was reasonable in that context in finding that indeed that was a physical threat. And in that context, the board also found that he was discharged because of everything that had gone on at the job. But it's not just about his reporting a plumbing violation to the plumbing code. That was sort of intertwined because the company says, well, a union guy reported us to the plumbing inspector. So it's not just an independent action of him trying to kind of circumvent some of the supervisors there. The supervisors definitely thought that that was intertwined with his union activity.
So I found that kind of a rather odd argument all around, the idea that you get to fire people who report you to the authorities for code violations. It seems strange to me. But I wonder if you could turn to these 20 people, because most of these applications were signed in January, right?
Okay.
And even the majority members of the board say there's nothing wrong with an employer saying, I'm going to keep applications for 30 days. Isn't the obvious reading of these applications that the date on the application is what governs?
Well, the board is certainly not taking issue with the company's ability or even rationale for having a 30-day rule. The board is taking issue with whether or not the company, in fact, relied on that rule. They could very well have had the rule, but the board is saying that it's pretext and it was not relied on. And
so the board's position is that this is just a capriciously enforced rule?
Absolutely. There's only one witness that testified to exactly what the 30-day rule was and how it was enforced. And the board basically made a credibility determination that he was not reliable and that, in fact, he did not rely on the 30-day application. And that's basically because of he's the highest person in the company, and he, in fact, was one of the people that committed some of the unfair labor practices in this case.
Can I ask you whether this case was litigated on the basis of the 30-day rule per se, just the application says January, now it's March, ergo it's too late, or was it litigated on the theory of no renewed expression of interest in the job? I mean, I'm just trying to find out to what extent we're talking about the same things now that were before the board.
I'm not entirely sure.
Well, what Mr. Seidman just said was that there was an instance in which there was an old application for Neil, and he made a phone call and said, I'm still interested, and in that instance, the company was willing to talk to him. Well, that's a different theory than we will never talk to people with old applications. That's a theory that focuses on current expressions of interest, no matter how expressed, by telephone, by walking in the door, by filing a new application. So I want to know how that issue, if at all, was explored below.
Well, the board basically made the determination that with respect to those 13 applicants, they would not have hired.
Well, if the board decided that these people were rejected in a second, you know, these people were rejected the minute the top three applications show January 27th as the application date, or whatever it was, then calling a week later wouldn't really make any difference. They were out. There was no application on file. Is that what the board decided?
Yes, the board basically decided that the company looked at the application, saw a voluntary union organizer at the top, and said, we don't want anything to do with this. And, I mean, we're saying that the company did not rely on a 30-day rule. We don't know whether or not they looked at the date or not. We have no idea. We're saying that that rule was not relied on, and that, in fact, they saw the application, saw a voluntary union organizer, and said, that's it, we don't, especially considering the fact that the company was really in need of plumbers. I mean, they're advertising, continuously putting advertisements in the paper from September of 96 until, December of 96 until September of 97. One of the supervisors, Kurt, said, you know, we're in a real bind for help, and the record shows that way more than 20 applicants were hired during this relevant period.
Is that how you come up with 20, by looking at that whole period, December through the following September? Because another of Mr. Seidman's points is that there were only 7 spots anyway, mm-hmm. and 13 people is more than 7.
Sure. Under the board theory, the relevant time period here is December 96 to September of 97. And so the board found that there were you know, in excess of 20 jobs filled, so there's no question of there being jobs open for the 20 that applied. So, I mean, it's clear that they were hiring. It's clear that the 20 applicants were qualified. I mean, the only real qualification that was ever given in the newspaper article for advertisement was that these plumbers have licenses, and all 20 indeed had licenses. And in there's evidence in the record that the company hired a lot of non-union applicants who did not have plumbing licenses, so that goes to show the disparate treatment of these union organizers. And so the company really has shown nothing more than its refusal to hire union applicants, and they have really not proved at all that absent their union membership, they would have not hired them anyway. I mean, their wage history rule proves that as well. I mean, there's certainly evidence of the company having hired non-union individuals who were making more than that $13 to $15 an hour range.
For two people, right. But what, another point Mr. Steedman has made has to do with burden of proof, and his claim is that it's the board's obligation to show that these were not stale applications before you can even get to the point of worrying about whether the statement at the top about being a union organizer had anything to do with this.
I believe you're referring to his argument that it's the board's burden to prove of availability and willingness
right.
to accept the job. Well, that argument, in making that argument, he relies on footnote 18 of FES. That footnote is talking only about a refusal to consider a violation and compliance proceeding with respect to that. They're talking about when a job opening comes later on. We're not talking about a job opening that sticks in time. We're talking about a refusal to consider. And while you're litigating that refusal to consider, a job opening then arises. Then the general counsel has to open a compliance proceeding, determine whether or not the applications that were previously submitted are now active and that person is still interested for this job that has just opened up. But in this case, we're not talking about that. We're talking about jobs that are open and already filled, fixed in time. And the company also relies on StarCon, which sort of adopts footnote 18. And I can't take a position on that because the board has yet to review StarCon. It hasn't sort of made its way up through the board yet.
The new round of StarCon, you mean?
I'm sorry?
The new round of StarCon.
That's right, yes, the supplemental decision. The board has not had an opportunity to review the ALJD's supplemental decision.
Is it on appeal to the board?
It is currently. But we're not, I don't know. I couldn't speak for the board, and I don't know what the board would do, whether they would adopt that or not. But certainly as it stands now, FES does not require that the general counsel have to show the availability or the activeness of the applications in the sense that another job is opening up. I mean, by them making an application, they're available for work. Anything that has to do with that is really compliance. So that's absolutely not anything that's in the general counsel's burden under FES at the moment. I think the board will rest on its feet, but there's no other questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Gross, you had about 5 minutes or so.
If it pleases the court, William Gross, attorney for the intervener, Indiana State Pipe Trades Association. I will confine my remarks to the assaulting, refusal to hire allegations. I do think it's worth noting at the outset, though, that the union's salting efforts in this case did result in a board-conducted mail ballot election, which is actually reported in the board reporter at 326 NLRB 493. In other words, this salting campaign was not simply to precipitate an unfair labor practice. It was part and parcel of a union's systematic effort to organize this employer from the grassroots, from the bottom up. Now, it's I think in this case the employer is essentially arguing.
What was the result of the election?
Well, I was afraid you'd ask me that. The union did not prevail. There was an issue, a unit issue, as to whether the electricians employed by Massengill should be included with the unit of plumbers, and the regional director found that the electricians should be included, and as a result, the Plumbers Union did not prevail. I think in essence what the employer is arguing here is that the general counsel should have an extra burden of proof that the board has never imposed upon general counsel in a refusal to hire case, which is essentially a requirement that the general counsel demonstrate that after applications are submitted that the employees retain an interest in the jobs for which they have applied. Now, I would point out that, of course, the application on its face did not require that employees follow up with a phone call or a personal visit. It didn't specify, for example, that after you submit this application, you have to call every day, every week, once a month. There's no such
But it does say it would be considered active for only 30 days. It seems like it was a fairly sloppy salting campaign if they are giving this batch of 13 applications 2 months after the employees filled them out.
Well, except that, of course, the 30-day rule is on its face ambiguous, and it's not clear whether that 30 days would begin to run from the date that the application was signed or from the date that they were turned in. I mean, what if, for example, the application hadn't been dated at all? I think it was perfectly reasonable for both the board to infer and the union to infer that the 30 days would begin to run from the date that the application was submitted, which is the manifestation of the interest in the jobs that are available. And the employer is essentially arguing that the general counsel has this affirmative burden to prove this continuing interest. But it would be extremely ill-defined, and I don't know how it could possibly be implemented or applied in a trial before the board. I think at the minimum, the employer would have to impose those follow-up requirements in the applications themselves and specify exactly what those requirements are. That's why we view this argument as essentially a rearguard attack on the Town and Country case, which holds that, you know, that submitting an application is all you need to do to establish your bona fide interest in employment with this employer, which is in a hiring mode and which is in fact hiring. Otherwise, you're imposing this additional layer of proof that neither this court nor the board has ever required. In fact, the way I look at this, the employer in this case is essentially, you know, relying on Chairman Hurtgen's dissent, and I question whether Chairman Hurtgen's dissent is really consistent with this court's decision in StarCon and with the Third Circuit's decision in FES.
You have 1 minute.
Okay.
If you'd like to wrap up.
Sure. Unless the court has other questions, so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Siebman.
I have just a few points I'd like to address. The first issue, Your Honor, you asked Ms. Kelly if the board was contending that the 30-day active application rule was capriciously enforced. She said yes, but of course offered no evidence to back that up. It's undisputed in the record, as pointed out by Member Hurtgen. There was neither evidence nor indeed even claim by the board that the company had discriminatorily applied this, nor did the board offer any evidence that the company had accepted stale applications from non-union applicants.
Could I ask you if you would have regarded this as a different case if all 13 of those people had come in the middle of March and put their applications down on the table, even though the application said January 27th, that's when they signed it?
I can't speak for what Massengale would have done directly on that. I was going to raise that exact analogy because I think that does show something different. And this is a point Mr. Groth, I think, incorrectly stated. A person manifests their interest at the time they fill out the application, as Member Hurtgen said. And as you also said, Your Honor, it's obvious from the application, given that you're filling it out, the 30 days is from when you fill it out. But
I didn't say it. I said that could be argued.
In any event, that's the more logical, I think, interpretation. But getting to the point that you've got is when I show up, when I'm there, when I filled it out is not as important.
But that indicates ambiguity in the statement on the piece of paper, because if it really is the piece of paper, then it's already late. You'd have to say, please sit down, fill out a new application if you want to do it. Maybe your address has changed, maybe your phone number, whatever I need, or at least just scratch out the date and write a new date down. Whereas what you're telling me now is that there are, in fact, two possible standards, the date that you turned in or the date that you filled it out.
I misspoke, if that's what you understood me to say, or if I said that. I think that what you do is exactly the common sense thing you do. If in that scenario you look at the application, you turn it in, more often than not, you're going to scratch it out or you're going to be told to make out another application. We have to remember that none of these people showed up.
But
none of these people submitted their application.
No one said, though, to the person who gave them the application, you know, we don't take anything that has a date on the application. Perhaps Had they been told that, they would have gotten the current signatures.
There's no evidence even in the record that at the time it was turned in, we even knew what the dates of the applications were. This was turned into a clerical person who simply took the application from the person. It's not often the case in that scenario when you get a bunch of applications. I mean, it's common sense. You're going to look through all of them immediately and check the dates, say, hey, these aren't timely.
Right.
That's
and no evidence that you even looked at all the dates either, right, because it's the one you missed.
Well, I wouldn't say it that way. The evidence shows that they were all of them rejected out of hand for being stale. That's the evidence in the record. It could be that there was a mistake with respect to one of them that we have learned is dated March 27, I believe. This is an unusual case. Normally, when a person fills out their application, they're turning it in or somebody's dropping it off for them now or within a day or two of doing the application. In that situation, maybe you don't have to give more evidence of interest or availability. The board has always said you have to have proof of application. But when I fill out an application on January 6th in the construction industry where applications are fail quickly, and I turn it in 2.5 months later, the employer in that situation rightly says, now this person probably has another job by now. Why check with them? People that did call back in had the opportunity. Jack Neal did it because he showed his true interest, and interest is communicated. Any other questions that the three of you have? We believe that Member Hurtgen was correct, and for the reasons he articulated and the additional reasons set out in our briefs, this court should deny enforcement of the board's order and grant Massfield's petition to the extent requested. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all counsel.